39 Steps to Mediation.
You're listening to Outlook, one of the Commercial, Construction and International Arbitration podcast series brought to you by the members of 39 Essex Chambers.
So hello and welcome to this, the first in our series of talks by the various mediation groups from 39 Essex Chambers. We're talking today about civil liability, particularly clinical negligence, personal injury claims, product liability and insurance claims. And I'll introduce my colleague, Shaman Kapoor, who's joining me for this, which will be a question and answer discussion of what we think we can provide and what experiences we may have that's useful to anyone who's listening. So I'm William Norris, KC. I'm very elderly now and have been practiced very many years, specializing in various things, including personal injury claims. And I am the general editor of Kemp & Kemp, which is still the Bible on personal injury damages. And my colleague Shaman will explain himself.
Thank you, William. My name is Shaman Kapoor. I'm a practitioner, a barrister at 39 Essex Chambers. And of course, William, you and I are colleagues, and we have been for the last 5 years, about which I am delighted. My practice has been a mix of civil liability broadly, a bit of commercial litigation, and a fair bit of costs and litigation funding. And I've been a mediator since 2015.
I think both of us have quite a lot of experience of mediation. I did the qualification as a mediator quite a few years ago. I think both of us have done mediations as mediators and indeed been present at mediators as advocates with some idea of what works and what doesn't work. The 39 mediation group is split into various sections. Shaman and I are talking here about the civil liability group, but there's public law, construction, planning, and so forth, which is also in these chambers. But we're focusing here on what is really our area of main personal expertise, which is personal injury, clinical negligence, product liability, and insurance. And within the mediation group, we would have lots of practitioners who have mediation qualifications, and we would have everyone who has those qualifications will also have personal experience of mediation and what works and what doesn't work. And presumably, Shaman, if someone wants to come to us for a mediator, they will have a wide range of whatever sort of personal seniority they might like.
Absolutely, William. It seems, as with our work at the bar, we have a long and checkered menu of options when it comes to mediators, with a ranging level of experience and seniority, and obviously different skill sets.
What should we say to the customer are the primary benefits of using us as mediators?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it, that in spring 2025, as we are, mediation seems to be a bit of a viral word these days, obviously with Churchill and so on. And there's definitely a greater movement towards mediation and a reception for mediation. But ultimately, the features, I think, of mediation have been around for quite some time. And I think the key features of a successful mediation would include, firstly, willing participants, then participants that come with instructions.
Yeah, otherwise it kind of is a waste of time, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think from the mediator's perspective, if the participants haven't themselves developed some sort of structure, then I think it's incumbent on mediators to formulate a structure as best they can.
Well, let's just pick that up, Shaman. So you're asked if can you do a mediation in a month's time? Just give us an idea of the kind of structure that you as a mediator would expect to, I'm going to say, impose on your customers, impose on the parties, but I mean, suggest to the parties is perhaps a better way of putting it.
Yeah, I think the starting point is to identify what it is that they want out of a mediation. Often participants want different things. And as you will know, there's, aside from there being a menu of mediators, there's a menu of services that a mediator can offer, whether it's facilitative, evaluative, or dealing with one particular point, or dealing with a raft of issues. And so I think it's important to identify what services are required, because for me, the first thing that I wish to do is to bolt down the agreement of the mediator with the participants, because that will be the structure for the mediation. And I think at times participants want to even negotiate about the terms of the mediator's role.
Yeah, and they know where they stand then come the mediation. I think without any structure, it's absolutely hopeless. But I completely agree that the first and foremost thing is to find out what the parties want to achieve. And as you say, they may not share the same objectives. But why go to mediators rather than, as most of us have done throughout our careers, why not just sit round the table with the other side and have a joint settlement meeting or a round table meeting or whatever we like to call them?
The starting point, and I suspect you found this too, but people come to you as a mediator because of your reputation and because of your experience in an area or your reputation for having a particular skill set. And I think people often talk about a trusted mediator or having confidence in your mediator. Actually, I often find, I don't mean this as if to shout from a glass tower, but I think it's respect for the mediator from the participants that causes that tripartite arrangement to work. Because if the respect and the trust isn't there, the participants will not have faith in the process. And I tend to believe that when one is instructed as a mediator, you've got past that and therefore you are credited with the ability to be flexible about your structure, but at least to have a structured approach, and the participants will receive it well.
I mean, I guess we're talking here in the context of litigation, cases that either are being litigated or about to be litigated. I mean, why can't they just sit down and see if they can negotiate a deal for 50,000, 5 million, or whatever it may be? That's what we've always done, isn't it?
You're absolutely right. Chances are they have tried, haven't they?
Yeah, or their clients are difficult.
Or a number of different features play in. I mean, sometimes you find that clients are difficult. Sometimes you find that there are features and factors that are not ordinarily within the litigation sphere as being a factor that is relevant, but in fact it might be a very relevant factor or a stumbling block that only can be grappled within a more flexible environment such as mediation. And so you would expect all forms of alternative dispute resolution to have been attempted at some point, including negotiation. But mediation is the involvement, isn't it, of a third party neutral with that trust and that respect to bring the parties closer.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And it's, I think, a mistake to think of mediation only where the parties have completely fallen out and can't resolve their differences. I think an experienced and constructive mediator can really, even if the parties, I mean, if the parties can simply agree matters very easily, then they don't need a mediation. But a mediator can provide a structure for and guidance within the parties' discussion, which may help parties who would otherwise eventually get there in some form or other to get there rather more quickly and perhaps in a more satisfactory way.
I agree, William. I think the structure led from the agreement and the experience of the mediator will move the participants along, which of course is the art, isn't it? That's the train journey that they're on.
Yeah, I mean, it's just an additional cost. And it's probably, if the mediator can bring real value to the negotiating process, even if the parties might have got there themselves eventually, actually engaging a mediator to assist with the process and providing structure, it seems to me to be money pretty well spent. At least that's how I would think we as mediators could be useful.
I agree.
Can I ask you what you think about neutral or evaluative mediation as a sort of alternative processes?
Well, I think it has value. I think it is a specific process. It's a specific option on the mediation menu.
What you mean? Do you have the evaluative element, do you mean?
Yes, I do. And I think it's certainly in cost mediations, I've seen participants come from the outset with the specificity of a request for evaluative mediation on a given point, for example, that the participants are themselves struggling with. So I've seen that happen. I've also seen mediations which typically start in the usual facilitative way, evolving into a request for evaluative mediation.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, I've given you two extremes in my question there. And the evaluative mediation is where the mediator will actively say, I think this is the answer or this is the value, and may say it to both parties. But if at the other extreme you've got the neutral mediator who simply says nothing more than, so Shimon, how do you feel about this? Oh, William, how do you feel about this? I mean, that seems to me to be an absolutely useless role. I do think there are many shades of grey in between where you have a mediator who, even by the use of a raised eyebrow or just a, I see, provides a pretty useful steer to the parties as to whether they think the point the parties make is a good or a bad one.
It's interesting, isn't it? You've hit an interesting nail on the head there. The formula in one's head as a mediator before you get into a mediation, certainly I find it always helps me to go back to some of the training that I received to get yourself in the right mindset for that approach. Not ever, hopefully, as bad quite as that, you know, how do you feel and so on and so forth. But it's an interesting shift in mindset to putting the participants to their election to say what their reaction is, in a way in which I suppose litigation isn't so much the expression of the reaction, rather the reaction itself. And so you begin to unpick in the mediation process what it is that are the pulls and the pushes.
No, I agree. But one thing I would say is absolutely key, and it's key whether you're talking about acting as a mediator or acting as an arbitrator, which I do mostly these days. And that is, if you are the mediator or you are the arbitrator, of course you need to read all the papers carefully in advance. But what you must never do is to try and see how you would argue the case, because you're then putting yourself in the position of one of the parties that you think that's good or that's bad. So I think you've got to be very careful when you're giving a steer or providing an evaluative response, just not to see it as I would argue the case this way. I think that's not your role. I think your role in the first place is to listen and balance and to provide encouragement or discouragement only when it's obvious that it's going to be helpful to the process. And the process that you're overseeing is a negotiation which is thought is going to be most profitable if you are present rather than the parties aren't doing it alone.
Yeah, I entirely agree. And I think it's interesting that, again, I come back to the agreements, the mediation agreement, because in my mediation agreement, I'm sure similarly in yours, the parties have to formally decide that they want evaluative mediation. If at the outset they haven't opted for it, but later choose to do so in the mediation, we have to have another revision to the agreement so that it is properly enabled. And it's interesting that that shift is an important shift, because it shifts the mindset of the mediator too, from being the non-evaluative third party in that facilitative process to now becoming one where you might express, where you're in fact, you're required to express your views on a particular point.
So here's a question. If you, let's take, we're talking about parties who've got a personal injury claim that they want to have mediated. Do they need to use a mediator who has some experience of personal injury law? I mean, obviously, and practice. I mean, obviously they do if they're wanting an evaluative mediation, but can they use a sort of good egg mediator, even though the mediator knows nothing about how PI claims work in practice, or product liability case where the mediator knows nothing about that, or somebody has no experience of clinical negligence? I mean, is that going to work?
I hear from experience that it does work and can work. And certainly we come across, don't we, mediators on circuit that have never been in practice, in fact, but have only ever qualified as mediators in practice. Their practice has been mediation. We see and hear of mediators with very broad reach in terms of their mediation experience. And I find it fascinating and interesting, particularly being a barrister and carving out expertise, you would think that it couldn't possibly work. But it seems that mediators are successful, even if they don't have the specific experience in a sector. However, again, I think that when participants come to choosing a mediator, they will inevitably wish to prefer someone who's got the experience in the sector. I mean, it must be so, mustn't it?
I'm not really on the side of the mediator who knows nothing about the particular subject. I mean, I have some experience of this as a party, And, you know, if the party, if the advocates on one side or the other know immeasurably more about law, principle, practice than the mediator, really the mediator's got, to my mind, precious little to bring to the party, possibly from keeping the parties apart from throttling each other from time to time. But I think you want a mediator who knows the subject personally. You know, to go to someone who says, well, I've done a bit of PI or I've done a bit of contract, so I know this is a clinical negligence case. How can I help? I'm not sure that's money well spent on the mediator. I mean, it may work, but I think you're much better off with someone who knows the field.
Do you think that's necessarily the case if the outcome is likely to be beyond the sort of outcome that a court could determine?
No, I think not necessarily the case, but I'm absolutely sure that when you're a client, solicitor, client looking for mediators or barrister asked to suggest someone to mediate the case. And I'm sure my first port of call would be to someone who knew what they were talking about. You know, imagine I know the field well, my opponent, for whatever reason, doesn't. I think to have the mediator say to me, do you know, that's a bad point, or to say to the other side, do you know, they got quite a good point. I think it carries so much more clout if the mediator knows the field. I mean, have you had good and bad experiences in this particular area? I gave you a hint of one of my own. I wonder what yours are, Shaman.
I mean, I've been very lucky, I think, as mediator. My understanding is I still have, now this may be a reflection of not doing many in some people's eyes, but I think I've done a sufficient number every year since 2015. I think I've still got a 100% success record, would you believe? Most of my mediations have been, in fairness, cost mediations, and it's quite interesting because it ties into your point earlier, in fact, just made about the specialty and the expertise.
Yeah, you know what you're talking about in that field. See, I know nothing about costs except that I try to avoid anything to do with them at all points. So you have 100% success in mediations?
I do.
As a mediator?
As a mediator in that field. I've been a participant acting for participants in mediations not to do with costs, and those have been particularly complex. They've been group actions, they've involved compensation schemes and that sort of thing, as I know you have been too. And I think by and large, they are also successful. And in those sorts of cases, the thing that seems to be the driver, almost beyond anything else, is the confidentiality of the process, because you find that is particularly important to one side, if not both.
Just sum up for anyone who's kind enough to listen, what you think the key features of a successful mediation would be.
I think we come back to, in essence, the well-trodden selling points of mediation, which I think are pretty much four points: speed, cost, the ability to bespoke the process, and confidentiality. And I think ultimately those are things that come to drive the participants to formulate a solution for themselves, as much as they are flags for the success of mediation. The key is, isn't it, to put the participants in the controlling seats, or at least make them feel that way, rather than having to face the process of litigation in courts where, frankly, so much is out of your control.
Yeah, everything's out of your control, including, well, as you say, everything. But let's think about things we particularly dislike, things we like, things we don't like, perhaps, in mediations, based, no doubt, or informed by our bitter experience. Are you a particular fan of plenary sessions in which the parties all sit in the same room with the mediator there looking benign and asks the parties to explain themselves in advance? Is that a big help in your experience?
I've had mixed experiences, actually. I think as mediator, if you're going to call a plenary session, or at least start with a plenary session, you have to have thought long and hard about whether that's likely to work, given what you know about how dialogue has gone between participants.
What about if the parties aren't keen on it? I mean, would you encourage them, despite their own protestations, to go ahead with their plenary session?
I don't think I would insist on it until I've had some time with them individually.
We're assuming here, are we, that the parties... Perhaps we aren't assuming, I don't know. Have the parties, would you have expected them to have exchanged position statements in advance of the mediation?
I do tend to see that.
It's got to be a good idea, hasn't it?
I think so. I think it also allows them to bang their chest a little bit and get that out the way too. so that the time in mediation can be even more productive.
Yeah, but also the other thing is that the case is put on paper. Everybody on the other side can read it dispassionately in their own time without feeling the need to do ums, ahs, and ooh, and gestures of dismay or distress. My own view in cases, well, first of all, I would always have an exchange of position statements in advance, insist on it if I was mediator, insist on it actually if I were representing parties to a mediation. So I'm assuming I know what my opponent's case is. I'm assuming that I know what both sides' case is if I'm the mediator. If there are pleadings, you'll have seen that anyway, but regardless of pleadings, it's quite, I think, helpful to have things summarized, albeit briefly. I have never found it helpful as an advocate to have my opponent explain to me how strong they think their case is, or indeed look embarrassed and tell me how weak they think it is. I mean, we judge these things in advance of any court hearing, in advance of any roundtable meeting, in advance of any mediation, and we give advice to our clients based on that. And really hearing it talked about publicly serves, to my mind, only one purpose, well, two purposes. I said it runs up money and it drives away the prospects of settlement, because there's nothing more irritating than hear your opponents talking long and loud about how marvelous their case is, or reading out large sections of their position statement, including in one bitter experience that I can never forget, reading out case references as though the audience had the slightest interest in listening to 1965, 2 Queen's Bench, 45, even assuming we hadn't read the stuff in writing. But I do think, I mean, as sitting as an arbitrator or anybody else sitting as a judge, it is useful to hear this, to hear cases set briefly to music. And in mediation, if they want to hear something explained, then they do it in the privacy of their own room or come into your room to hear it. You don't want this to be done in public. I mean, that's an absolute no for me, these long plenary sessions, unless both sides actively want it. I can't imagine why they should. I can, actually. I think that, you know, sometimes if I have clients who really won't necessarily see what I've told them about the strength of my opponent's case, if I think their opponent's got quite a good case, it is sometimes helpful to them to ask your opponent to explain it so that, as it were, they have the same sense that you have. That's an example of a plenary session because I think it's going to be helpful to my party, but it's not just to give my opponent an opportunity to do a bit of showboating for the benefit of his clients.
And I wonder if there's an element of reflection in terms of the complexity of the cases that we're talking about, because at the lower end of the spectrum, lower end of the value anyway, of cases, one might not always see a position statement. Have you ever attended a mediation or been the mediator where the participants haven't put in a position statement?
No, I haven't. But if I were the mediator and for some reason there weren't position statements, I think then you would have a form of plenary session. But I think I would make a point of saying to both parties that I'm going to ask them to explain their position, but would urge them to do it as dispassionately as they reasonably can, because what you're trying to achieve at all times is reducing the temperature rather than inflaming it. And a plenary session, such as I've described a few moments ago, makes settlement less likely because it just pisses everyone off. Let me just ask another thing about, you know, what we're trying to avoid in mediations. You know, sometimes you hear people talk with a point of pride, you know, I kept them waiting and eventually at 2 o'clock in the morning, we got everyone to sign up. I mean, should we have long waits, long sessions? Is that a good thing?
I don't think it's a good thing. I don't think that sort of thing should ever be the making of a mediator, or put it a better way, the creation of a mediator. I have been in mediations where it has run into the evening. In fact, it's even run into the early hours. It should never happen. I think on one particular occasion, my thoughts were that I was part of a game that was being played, because the mediator's agreement had provided for hourly rates beyond a certain time, so they knew they were paying me, they knew what the rate was. One or other of the participants thought that they had locked in a fee for their lawyers and they were being particularly commercial about it all and just thought it was rather comical and amusing to allow this sort of thing to go on. Now, there's a fine line, because it seems to me one of the great powers in a mediator's agreement is the ability to bring a mediation to an end without any reason. And you don't have to give a reason to terminate a mediation as a mediator.
One reason you might have, I think this is very important, the mediation agreement ought to provide that the parties should come to the mediation with instructions as to when they will settle and when they won't. Don't you think?
Absolutely that. I mean, if you find that they're not there with goodwill and with genuine intention to settle, cut it and walk, and I agree with you.
I think so. If someone says, oh, I haven't got any instruction on this, say, look, actually, the mediation agreement makes it clear that... So I do think that the mediator in that situation ought to put some pressure on the parties, and perhaps in advance of the mediation, say you've sent the mediation agreement out a fortnight in advance, it's all been signed, just 24 hours, 48 hours before the mediation starts to remind parties position statements, if not already exchanged, and that the mediation should only go ahead if they have instructions, at least as the parameters within which a settlement might be possible.
I entirely agree. In fact, I think we've got forms of authority or forms with signatures causing them to declare that they have those instructions and that they're coming with the right intentions. Styles, you know, friendliness of mediators and that sort of thing. What are your thoughts on that?
I think one of the reasons you'll choose a mediator, particularly if you know them, is for their style or lack of it. I think actually we all are as we are. In the end, even though we may acquire a disguise, if you like, of being more serious than we usually are or more lighthearted than we usually are, actually, in the end, we end up as, particularly in a mediation, which is quite a personal process, the mediation is going to have their own personality. You need to have a mediator with a personality that you think is going to work. And so the over-friendly mediator may be completely the wrong mediator for a particular kind of case, but it may work very well for other cases. So I don't think we can say to the mediator, you must be X or Y. I think you must be yourself because that's the only long-term solution. You can't pretend to be someone else for very long. And you're only going to get going. I think it's true if an advocate actually, you can watch what other people do and you can learn from them and you can use some of their tricks if you like. But in the end, you're going to be an advocate of your own style, of your own personality. And the same is true of mediators. It may not be true of judges. Judges can do all sorts of things, but mediators have to be themselves.
Yes, I entirely agree. And it's interesting, isn't it? You be yourself, but you bring your skill set. And as we know, we have different modes, different gears, a different intensity. And ultimately, I suppose, it's that human skill set that becomes all the more important in mediation. And that's hopefully why they chose you in the first place.
The scheme we're going to run from these chambers is going to have fixed fee rates, isn't it? I mean, all of which are going to be available to anyone who wants to know what they are. And that's, I think fixed fee rates is quite a good plan, isn't it? So that people don't have, I mean, some of these cases are just open-ended with hourly rates where mediations go on and on and on and adjourn for further mediations. That seems to be a thoroughly bad idea. So I quite like the idea of fixed fees. Do you think that works?
I think it works. I think it works for the participants. It works for the budget holders, probably. And they can put a very clear line in the sand for the cost. They can assess the proportionality of the experience of mediation by knowing what their total exposure is from the outset. So I think it works. I also think, actually, it dovetails very well, and this is not in any way a threat, but it dovetails with the mediator's right to terminate a mediation at any time. I think there's a fantastic connection between those two things because it forces the participants then to come with the right mindset to participate willingly in a mediation with instructions for it to be productive, failing which, if the mediator feels like it will be terminated and that opportunity will be lost. So they will have been the maker of their own misfortune if they don't come with the right instructions and mindset to have incurred a fixed fee that outwardly looked like a reasonable deal, but then if it was terminated early, didn't turn out too good for them.
Yeah, I think 1396's plan is that the fees, except for exceptional cases where you might have to have more flexibility, it's going to be price per party, mediator appropriate call, etc., and rooms in chambers. I think that's how we will work it.
Well, thank God there's good coffee here, right, William?
Yes, well, if you know how to work the machine, which of course I don't. I know what I was going to ask you something about. I think you've had a bit of a look at the issue of how mediators have to be aware of cognitive bias. And especially if you're dealing in with a mediator who's an evaluative mediator or just someone who's giving a nudge here and there, that mediator needs to be aware of the dangers of cognitive bias, don't they?
Absolutely. It's really interesting, this, because this is certainly in the playbook for the judiciary, would you believe? In fact, the guide for the judiciary and the training for the judiciary about this, I think, is really quite good. And I think the ability to transfer skill set from a judicial role holder, I think use it part-time or have done in the past, and I certainly do, I think is very useful, very transferable. And it's interesting that I think mediators, to be good, must have in mind the risk of cognitive bias. We see bias coming in so many different forms, don't we? I mean, there's confirmation bias, similarity bias. I mean, there's probably all sorts of labels for the different types of biases, but I think it's important for mediators to be mindful of it and to have demonstrated an awareness of it in order to buoy the credibility of the process and their own skills.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, actually, on a separate point, but related, it's one of the reasons why all the hearings, the sports hearings I do as an arbitrator, particularly the international ones in all cases, but even the UK ones, I would say that 90, 95% of them are remote hearings. And I think that one of the advantages of remote hearings, apart from the fact that I can do them from home, one of the active advantages is that it does eliminate some of the bias which may otherwise be unavoidable. I don't mean active bias, I just mean unconscious bias. The idea that by sitting in the same room as someone, they're coming into the courtroom or into the arbitral tribunal, we have to allow for the fact that this is a very alarming experience for most people giving evidence. Yes, they're doing it from home, they're going to be more relaxed. If you're not in the same room as them, you're less affected by whether you like or dislike them, as you instinctively do. That's part of the unconscious bias mindset, that we like people who are a bit like us, or we like people who conform to our norms. I do think that works. But just slightly leads me on to ask you, perhaps our last question is whether we think that a mediation could work remotely. Obviously not in the same way as if it's in the same building, but actually, why shouldn't we be prepared to provide remote mediation? I mean, no reason at all, is there?
None that I can think of. In fact, I take fuel from what you've just said about bias. I'll come back to address your point immediately. But it's interesting, isn't it, that really your point is that by having a remote mediation, there are more features that are neutralized that could lend themselves to be exposed to bias, whether conscious or unconscious.
I mean, that's so important. There are cultures in which, you know, looking someone in the eye is absolutely contraindicated, and yet we in Western culture have been brought up to trust the person who looks you in the eye and looks like a good egg. And yet that may be a guide, but you've got to be very careful. So I like the objectivity of remote hearing.
Yes, I really like it. I really like identifying remote mediation with that benefit. And I can see it and I entirely concur. And then to your question, you know, shouldn't we be offering remote mediation? Absolutely we should. I mean, it worked through COVID, didn't it? Through lockdown. I mean, everything seemed to work through lockdown so well. Mediation, particularly supported by the IT systems that we have, where you have people in different rooms, just in the same way as you would do physically, but being able to do so online and then shuttling between rooms as you wish. And then if there was the need for plenary, by all means, having a plenary and so on. I think it works really well.
I mean, there are lots of clients who want to be present in the same building and so forth. And so I guess the norm will still be in-person mediations, which we can accommodate and will accommodate here. But I mean, what we're ending up on saying is that if people think they want to give a remote mediation a try, we see no reason why it shouldn't be as effective and probably cheaper.
I concur entirely. What about an absolute last point then, William? I appreciate you said that probably should have been the last one, but you know, classic advocate never wants to bring it to an end. How about the end of a mediation? Let's just maybe quickly touch on this point if we can, and this will be the final point, the closing point. Settlement. Do we have a difference of opinion between us here?
No, I think we have a difference of experience. And the question is whether or not we should take any role in helping to draft or drafting the settlement agreement. I think the starting point is, one thing is absolutely clear, is that if the parties appear to have reached agreement, that needs to be recorded in a settlement agreement before the mediation ends. I mean, so far, so uncontroversial.
I think that's right, although I have conducted and been involved in mediations, and of course, knowing it to be a slippery slide, have permitted the participants, I say permitted, but the participants have agreed heads of terms with details to follow in weeks.
If that's what they want.
But I agree that the primary position is you want to see that an agreement broadly is bolted down before they leave.
Yeah, if you think they've reached agreement. I mean, it may be that the mediation actually ends up in two stages, that you get close to an agreement, but people need to think about it, so that's fine. I have no fixed position about what role, if any, the mediator should take in the drafting process. I think it's a matter for the parties, but I think the mediator would be neglecting their duties. If, for example, it was clear the parties had agreed X million in such an event, and the parties then produced the agreement, which didn't reflect what you understood, they'd really agreed, in which case mightn't you say, well, look, I think we've agreed A and B, but I'm not sure that this agreement reflects A and B very accurately. So, I mean, it's not for you to draft the agreement, but I do think it's for you to make sure that the agreement properly reflects what agreement they appear to have reached.
We are absolutely at one on that. Absolutely.
So we end on a note of unanimity.
There we go. Excellent. Well, brilliant. I've really enjoyed this chat, William. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. At 39 Essex Chambers, we cover a vast array of practice areas and sectors. You can find out more about our expertise and our barristers at 39essex.com, where you can also see our extensive catalogue of articles, podcasts, and webinars.